Historians note that while many of the coins minted in the first years of the rebellion had inscribed on them the words L'Chirut Zion, for the freedom of Israel, in the last year, as circumstances grew grim, the words were changed to L'Geulat Yisrael, for the redemption of Zion. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 87, The Coins of a Free Jerusalem. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. Ambassador Yaakov Herzog, in an eloquent appreciation of Theodor Herzl, noted the difference between the great Zionist leader's original approach and that of many Eastern European Jews who rallied to Herzl's cause. Herzog said, quote, Herzl arrived at the concept of political Zionism in an attempt to find a rational solution to the dilemma of Jewish survival as it appeared to him in Europe at the end of the last century. Denying the validity of the process of emancipation, he spoke and wrote of the Jewish people attaining a normal status among the nations of the world. But for the masses, who were gripped by his message and acknowledged his leadership, the goal was not normalcy. It was redemption, that indefinable feeling and urge that had remained inviolate in their innermost souls down the ages. Herzl's dialogue with them was therefore uneven. He spoke of liberation, independence, and normal status in terms of conventional political parlance. They answered him in terms of immortal prophecy, undying faith, and historic destiny. End quote. There is a difference, in other words, between liberation and redemption, though of course the two can be seen as going hand in hand. This is a fascinating point in itself, but it is even more fascinating when we realize that the distinction Herzog makes between liberation and redemption can also be found in different coins minted in Jerusalem during the rebellion. Coins that tell a story all their own, but also which mask what was going on behind the scenes within the city. If we learn all we can from these coins about what occurred in the past, then we can truly appreciate and approach the age in which we live today. From the very beginning of the revolt, one of the ways in which Jewish Jerusalem illustrated its independence was through the minting of its own coins, for use as currency, and in paying the half-shekel tribute to the temple. Following many, many years of using Tyrian coins for supporting the offerings atop the Temple Mount, the minting of Jewish coins served as the ultimate form of political and spiritual pronouncement and propaganda. To this day, many coins minted in the years 66 to 70 CE survive. More are constantly being discovered, largely from the middle of the revolt, but with some of the most interesting, dating to the first and final years of the rebellion. We have sent you images of some of these coins, and studying them can teach us much about the mindset of those leading the revolt from within the city. What is striking, first and foremost, are the actual letters imprinted upon them. They are ancient Hebrew, known as Ketav Ivri, rather than the form of the alphabet that was used in the Second Temple period, as well as in Hebrew to this day. The statement being made, clearly, was that the people sought to renew a Jerusalem of the past, a Jerusalem that was not under foreign domination, as it was for so much of the Second Temple period. What was sought was the Jerusalem of David, of the prophets, of Solomon's temple. Hence, what is also interesting is some of the phrases printed on the coins in this ancient Hebrew. Gershon Bar Kochba and Aaron Horovitz tell us the following in their book, A Temple in Flames, quote, the fact that the silver shekels minted by the rebels could be used for paying the half-shekel tax represented the Jews' spiritual break from the bonds of Rome. Until then, they had been forced to use the official shekels minted in Tyre, which bore foreign images. The Greek inscription on the Roman coin, the holy city of Tyre, was replaced on the Jewish shekels with the Hebrew words in archaic Hebrew letters, Yerushalayim HaKdosha, the holy city of Jerusalem, or Shekel Yisrael, shekel of Israel, end quote. And then there are the images that appear on the coins, almost all of them agricultural or temple related. Most interesting for us, perhaps, is that on the coins minted in the first year of the rebellion. On one side of one such coin, we see pomegranates, or rimonim. The pomegranate is one of the seven special fruits of the Holy Land, one which would have been brought to the temple each year in the ceremony of the first fruits. But the pomegranate has more significant symbolism than just that. It's often taught in Jewish day schools today that if you count the seeds of a pomegranate, you will find that it will have 613 seeds, parallel exactly to the number of commandments in the Torah. This is, of course, unrealistic because pomegranates come in different sizes with various amounts of seeds, though it does bear mentioning that, as Dr. Ara Zivitovsky tells us, a graduate student by the name of Alexander Hobold once counted the seeds in many pomegranate specimens, and he, quote, calculated the average number of seeds in 206 pomegranates from around the world and found it to be exactly 613, end quote. Be that as it may, nowhere does a traditional Jewish text say that there are 613 seeds in a pomegranate. But what does exist is a rabbinic statement that when it comes to the people of Israel, afilu reikim shebahem meleim mitzvot kerimon, even the emptiest among them are filled with mitzvot, like a pomegranate is filled with seeds. The rimon, the pomegranate in other words, was the embodiment of abundance, physical and spiritual, and it therefore could serve on the coin as a sign of both prosperity and religiosity. But there is another aspect to the pomegranate, and this can be explained by another amazing discovery from the Second Temple period, even more amazing because the object uncovered was so very tiny. As Bar Kochba and Horovitz further note in their book, it was in 2011 that a small golden tiny bell was found in a drainage channel of Jerusalem, a bell that was apparently part of the glorious garment of the high priest, whose hem featured in the words of the Torah. Pa'amon v'rimon, pa'amon v'rimon, gold bells and golden pomegranates, creating a sound heralding the high priest's arrival in the sanctuary. Josephus recounts that one of the signs of Roman dominance in Jerusalem had been their holding on to the garments of the high priest, keeping them to themselves, and only giving them to the Jews if they so chose. Thus, the pomegranate would have embodied both Jerusalem and the Holy Land at large, both the holiness of the temple and its freedom from Roman interference. That is one side of a first-year rebellion coin. But the other side of the coin is more mysterious. It seems to be a large goblet. What is that? Many scholars interpret it as the goblet or bowl in which the grain offering known as the Omer was brought in the temple every year on the day after the Passover celebration, meaning on the second day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And I would conjecture that if this is the case, the image on the coin is hearkening back, perhaps, to the first time that the produce of the Holy Land was eaten by the people Israel. And that is when Joshua crossed the Jordan and prepared to conquer the land. Joshua chapter 5. While the people of Israel were encamped in Gilgal, they kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at evening in the plains of Jericho. And on the morrow after the Passover, on that very day, they ate of the produce of the land, unleavened cakes and parched grain. And the manna ceased on the morrow when they ate of the produce of the land, and the people of Israel had manna no more, but ate of the fruit of the land of Canaan that year. The coins, in other words, minted by the rebels of Jerusalem, spoke of Jerusalem, but not only of Jerusalem. Indeed, the coins emphasized that Jerusalem was the beating, pulsating, spiritual heart of the land of Israel, that all Israelite eyes were turned toward it, and that from Jerusalem itself all holiness flowed. The very words stamped upon the coin stated their ultimate aspiration. Jerusalem was holy, and it was free. But what was actually occurring within the city as Vespasian assaulted the Galilee? Here is what we know actually occurred. Following the destruction of Josephus's fortress town of Yotvata in 67 CE, Vespasian assaulted several other sites in the north, including Gush Chalav, defended by Josephus's rival in the area, Yochanan, otherwise known as John of Giscilla. Titus, acting on behalf of his father, arrived at the walls of Gush Chalav on the Jewish Sabbath. Yochanan, in turn, informed Titus that he would be willing to engage in a discussion of the terms of surrender, but would have to wait until after the sacred Jewish day. Yochanan then utilized the brief moment of respite to flee with his army, though all that were left or caught were slaughtered by Titus. Yochanan took refuge in Jerusalem, as, during the year 68, civil war essentially broke out between various factions in the city. The formal leaders of the revolt, including the former high priest Hanan ben Hanan, was opposed by Elazar bar Shimon, leader of the group known as the Zealots. The Zealots were ultimately trapped in the temple by the larger group of rebels, as Yochanan arrived, offering to serve as mediator. That, as Bar Kochba and Horovitz explained, was not actually his intention. And Yochanan invited 20,000 Idumeans, the descendants of those who had converted to Judaism, to come to the city, falsely telling them that Hanan was seeking to surrender. These Idumean forces stole into the temple and helped the Zealots slaughter their rivals, including Hanan, before they, the Idumeans, realized that Yochanan had lied to them. Yochanan, in turn, was pushed back into the inner temple area along with the zealot forces. Meanwhile, another famous rebel, Shimon bar Giora, entered the city and was proclaimed by many as leader of the revolt. Thus, Jerusalem now had three purported leaders of the rebels: Elazar, the original leader of the zealots, Yochanan of Gush Chalav, and Shimon bar Giora. They all turned on each other. The coins speak of a wholly independent Jerusalem, but at its core, during the time of these objects being minted, it was a hate-filled Jerusalem. Guy McLean Rogers, in his book on the rebellion, emphasizes that Jerusalem ultimately fell because its leaders had no larger military strategy for facing Rome. The rabbis of the Talmud emphasized, first and foremost, that it was hatred for one another within Jerusalem that ensured the defeat. Of course, these two points ought to be taken in tandem. Having seen the failure of the battle for the Galilee, the immediate reaction of Jerusalem's leaders ought to have been unity, regrouping, and choosing a new strategy. Instead, what resulted was slaughter amongst themselves. Louis Feldman has noted the fascinating fact that the Talmud never mentions Josephus, either because the rabbi saw him as a traitor or because they disdained aspects of his life. Either way, the Talmud and Josephus both summarize why the rebellion failed. And in fact, Vespasian, according to Josephus, also recognized that the infighting was the greatest weakness of the revolt, which was part of why, throughout the year 68 into 69, Josephus chose to wait to attack. Josephus tells us that seeing his opponents slaughter each other, Josephus realized that his work was being done by those he sought to conquer. And this brings us to the difference between liberation and redemption. Historians note that while many of the coins minted in the first years of the rebellion had inscribed on them the words L'Cheirut Zion, for the freedom of Israel, in the last year, as circumstances grew grim, the words were changed to L'Geulat Yisrael, for the redemption of Zion. The truth is that Jerusalem always, always needs God's redeeming help. David's dream of a temple crowning Jerusalem was founded on the necessity of constantly reminding the chosen nation of this. But to ask God's redemption, the Jews of Jerusalem must also claim to merit it in the way they treat each other. In seeking both liberation and redemption, Jews are called to remind themselves what Herzl himself wrote in the Jewish State: we are a people, one people. Only when Jerusalem embodies that lesson can it truly ask God for redemption and continue to merit its freedom. We bear that lesson in mind today when we have the opportunity to use the 10-shekel coin in modern Israel, which is modeled directly on the coins of the rebellion, a constant reminder of the wondrous age in which we live. This is Meir Soloveitchik, wishing you a Shabbat Shalom, a Chodesh Tov, and a luminous Chanukah. Looking forward to learning together next week. Signing off.